The value of PTA, or parent-teacher meetings. Do those words strike terror in your heart? I hope not. In fact, I hope I can convince you that they're so valuable that it doesn't need to strike terror in your heart. I'd like for you to think for a little bit. Let's say there's a person over here in this city and he's building components to build a rocket. And there's another person over here in this city building components for the same rocket. Don't you think it would be wise for them to occasionally visit each other's workspace and even talk to each other sometimes? I think you get it. One of the things that's good for me is to remember that I'm working for the parents. My authority is a delegated authority. And a lot of the things I'm going to be saying this afternoon come a little bit more from a parent's perspective than a teacher's perspective. I want you to know what it's like to be me. Okay, now, I've been a teacher long enough to know that I know what it's like to be you also. So, this afternoon, just remember, yours is a delegated authority. It comes from the parents, so you need to visit with the parents. And believe it or not, we love those children just as much as you do. We want what's best for them, just like you do. One of the things I like about these meetings is that it lets me know, as a parent, how I can help you. You know, do you want me to be giving them flashcards at home? Do you want me to help my little one count? Do you want us to work on a language issue here at home? But it helps you as a teacher know how you can help the parent. Am I working at home on them being truthful? We can work together on that. And if we communicate, we'll both be working on the same thing and not against each other. One of the things that parents and teachers meeting together does is it keeps us from continuing to build on false assumptions. My sister-in-law came into my classroom when we had our parent-teacher meeting. She said, why are you giving my son so much homework? And I was appalled. He's one of my faster students, and I scramble to keep work ahead of him. And so we communicate, I'm not giving him any homework. Well, he comes home, he says, I have to get this done. As we communicate, I realized he wants as much of Friday as possible to read a book so he can read uninterrupted. And he was trying to get his work done at home so he could spend Friday at school reading a book. And all of a sudden, pieces of the puzzle began to fit into place. We wouldn't have known it had we not communicated that evening. Another thing that those meetings do is they help us to face things that we've kind of just been wishing weren't there, but they really are, and we need to just talk about them. It's special to me that this little talk happened on a day when there are some board members present. And so, y'all just don't have to listen, but board members, this is an evening that maybe the parents and the school teachers have looked forward to with kind of a mixture of dread and anticipation. And one of the things that, as a teacher and a parent, bother me is when a board member knows there are some issues that we really probably ought to talk about with all the parents and teachers and people present here. You have about three options. One is to have a 20 or 30 minute devotional. The other is to just ramble. And the other is to address the issue and to allow the parents and teachers then to proceed with their interviews. I think you know which one you should do. The other thing that board members tend to do, if I may just tell you this, we tend to say, well, there aren't really any problems. Why don't we wait until things aren't as busy to have our parent-teacher meetings? Just a quick illustration. I used this earlier in the day, but you've seen speedboats or maybe ridden in one. And when they take off, it's... But then once you get up on plane, you can really go. Don't wait until you're going like that to have a meeting. Use those meetings to keep you going. Teachers, be specific. Give examples. Parents, when you come to that meeting, be specific. Give examples. Don't ask your teacher, don't you think Grover Rodden's staff gives quite a big load in second grade? No, just tell them, I think you're sending too much homework. Now, if she's a new teacher, be gentle as you say that, but say it straight up. Teachers, tell your parent, don't say, we've had some trouble with bad language on the playground. Tell me, your seventh grader is saying this word. And you can even say the word. So I know what you're talking about. So that when we go home, we can work together. What we're doing is way more important than building rocket components. So let's communicate with each other. You say, well, what shall I talk about? And I had the list here, but we don't have time to go into it. Look at this book, Handbook for Creative Teaching. Look in the back, open to the page where it says communication at patrons' meetings. There's your list.
The value of research papers. You can stay seated. When he called me up and wanted me to do that, I honestly had a hard time getting inspired. But I tried. So, going into this last year teaching, I didn't see much value in research papers. One of the reasons being is I had to do several when I was in school as punishment material, and it was not a pleasant experience, to say the least. Once I discovered their place, my students and I actually really enjoyed them. In fact, they started popping off with them when they weren't even assigned. Come to school and say, hey, I found this in the encyclopedia at home, and oh, I read a book about this. You should really check this out. So, just a quick definition, make sure we're on the same page. In my mind, a research paper is a comprehensive compilation of notes and information gathered about a chosen subject. How comprehensive and the subject matter depends on the age and experience of the participants. For example, it would be unrealistic to expect a third-grade girl to enjoy writing a thesis on Einstein's theory of relativity. But in saying that, don't underestimate their intelligence either. This is my personal opinion, but things like this should never be used as punishment for material. I mean, maybe I have some PTSD from my school experience, but I don't know. Instead, I view them as something to be enjoyed and also to pique student interest in the wealth of interesting things that surrounds us. The purpose of school, a wise man once said, is not only to learn, but to learn to learn. Do I want my students to be limited to the information inside the textbooks or in my head? I want them to go far beyond that. And try to give them subjects that they can understand and appreciate. Because if they don't appreciate it, they're going to have a really hard time getting inspired about it. research papers. Okay, so I have found that there are student benefits and teacher benefits to research papers. At times when you're giving topics and devotions in church, you really think back about the times when you had to do oral reports in school, and all those times when you really wish you didn't have to stand up in front of your class. Like now, for instance. But that's one of the benefits I see, especially if you make them give them orally later. Well, you don't have to, but it's really good practice. So start with the students. Encourage the students to engage in any subject. It doesn't really matter, as long as it's interesting. Teach us how to utilize resources and gather pertinent information. So they shouldn't copy necessarily the whole section about the stitching in a sailboat sail when they're trying to write about the mast structure on a sailboat. Pick pertinent stuff. Teach them how to do that. Okay, teach us how to blend the information into something that is comprehensive and readable. It builds curiosity and interest in learning about new things, which are great things to be learning about, considering especially Jonathan Erb's talk about analytical skills, learning about new things. Okay, for the teacher, give students something to work on during free time. Whew, that's a big help. Can be a great opportunity to practice penmanship, grammar, and spelling. There's other ways you can do that too, but that was a fun thing I enjoyed. Can give you, as the teacher, a plan B if what you were planning for them to do has to be postponed or canceled. Just a word of warning, though. Stay involved and make sure they understand what is expected of them. There's nothing more frustrating as a student than to spend a whole afternoon working on your research paper and the teacher says, oh, well, I actually was thinking along these lines and what you did is really wrong. I mean, sorry. It's just, yeah, very, very tiresome. Okay, so these are some of the things I appreciate about research papers. I was going to quickly read some that my students wrote. I have a short one here, and one that is much more in-depth, and I don't know if I have time to read them both, but I'll read the short one first. Okay, the Boston Tea Party. It was written by one of my students last year. The Boston Tea Party, which happened on December 16, 1773, was an incident where 342 chests of tea were thrown from ships into Boston Harbor by American patriots disguised as Mohawk Indians. This led to the sparking of the American Revolution, which started in Massachusetts on April 9, 1775. It is estimated that they tossed more than 92,000 pounds of tea into Boston Harbor, which was enough to fill 18.5 million tea bags. The present-day value is $1 million. The chest shattered in the harbor, turning the water brown. The British response to the Boston Tea Party was to impose even harder policies on the Massachusetts colony. This was all an act against the King of England and the tax on tea. Okay, that's all I have time for. Thank you very much.
The value of map skills. How many of you have used a map, electronic or otherwise, in the last 7 days? Maybe get lost? Don't diverge. Let's quickly check out your map knowledge. Answer, you may answer this, true or false. A family flew, like if it's possible or not for them to do that. A family flew from New York to Portland in one day. A newly married couple drove to Hawaii in 5 hours from here. Mike, the missionary, drove to Belize in a week from here. You can drive to Lancaster from here in 30 minutes. True and false. I'm not sure if it's Lancaster or Lancaster here. There's one like less than 30 minutes from here. It's an unincorporated community, so anyway. A man drove, true and false, a man drove from Bangs to Bluff in 1 hour. What about Bangs to Canadian in half a day? I didn't say that wrong, I don't think. The first one is false. The second one is true, because there are two cities in Texas called that. He then went home to Truth or Consequences. That's one name. And yes, he could have probably done that. There's a Bangs, Texas, a Bluff, Alaska. Truth or Consequences is in New Mexico. Or how about these? Why not North Carolina or 96 South Carolina? Okay, Oklahoma. And that's just in the United States. A few quick points here. Knowledge of maps gives context to the words we say, like in a story or conversation. If someone is talking about Ukraine or Honduras or Belize, it gives us context. Knowledge of maps gives us a context for world happenings. Knowledge of maps gives context to places mentioned in God's Word. And knowledge of maps helps give students a foundation for more as they grow older. And really, a knowledge of maps may prepare a student to go out into the world one day and take the gospel to lost souls. Knowledge of maps helps us understand our history. It helps us understand God's creation better. Maps can invite us beyond our own little space. Knowing how to read a map could someday save your student's life, or maybe yours, because your phone might not work one day in a park, might have a reception. So one day it may save your student's life. A knowledge of maps can help us see where someone is mentally. If you knew nothing about maps, which is almost impossible to imagine in some ways, and what goes on in certain parts of the world, you might not want to go to Florida because it might be too cold. Or the Grand Canyon, I'd have to get my visa out. Or maybe, let's look at zebras, I think. I think that would be good. Let's go there. And, what, an hour drive to Romania or something? So you can see the context there. It's important. Or we could go to Antarctica now. That would be a cool trip. So don't throw away your maps this school year. Maybe you need to dig them out and dust them off, possibly. Remember how it may affect a student's life. What he learned may someday further God's kingdom. What he learned may help him understand a conversation he is in. What your student may learn may give him context and clarity to places mentioned in God's Word. You just may be building a bigger foundation than you know. And in conclusion, remember, maps can help put the world into perspective.
I begged for a little extra time, and I hope I don't waste it. The value of foreign languages. Nelson, I'm going to quote a little bit from Trevor Noah in his book, Born a Crime. Nelson Mandela once said, this is all the quote here. Nelson Mandela once said, if you talk to a man in a language he understands, that goes to his head. If you talk to him in his language, that goes to his heart. He was so right. When you make the effort to speak someone else's language, even if it's just basic phrases here and there, you are saying to them, I understand that you have a culture and identity that exists beyond me. I see you as a human being. Now, we could have talked about foreign language or the benefit of foreign language in the context of what they can do for us on the mission field. We could have talked about the benefits of foreign language in regards to learning them for our mental health. Did you know they say that if you learn a new language, it staves off Alzheimer's for 5 years? So hypothetically, if you would learn a new language every 5 years, you wouldn't get Alzheimer's till after you were dead. We could have talked about and somebody actually told me this one this morning, we could have talked about the using foreign language in school to keep overachieving students maximized. Sometimes the overachievers are the ones that don't get maximized, and having a language for them to pursue could be a fabulous way to maximize their time. But what this evolved into is something a little bit more like a look at what language is and the feasibility of actually teaching it successfully in our schools. So what is language? Quick look at the mental processes of producing and comprehending language, no matter what language you speak. First of all, we're going to brush through producing and then look a little bit more closely at comprehending. So the process for producing is your brain creates a mental model of a thought. No words involved. This is complex. And then your brain, starting now, when you decide to verbalize this mental model, your brain selects words, groups them into positions in the sentence, and then physically uses air and vibrations to create those words in real life. It's actually a complex process, and we make lots of mistakes when we do it. But not near as complicated as comprehension. So some of these examples also shed light on speech production. Let's look at that. The first step in you comprehending my speech is for you to cut the sound stream into words. Notice when I'm talking, it's a more or less constant flow of sound waves. Your brain has to decide where to cut that up into individual words, and there's more than one right way to do it. Beginnings and endings of words can be coupled together to make various combinations. And your brain has to hold all the possibilities until it can make sense out of the overall utterance, enough to know which combinations of sounds to discard and which to keep. you have to know enough words. This is kind of next level. If you don't know enough words, you can't comprehend what I'm saying. A normal American native English speaker might only use 5,000 to 8,000 words in speech production. But you probably, by this point in your life, know over 40,000 words. And that's what you use to comprehend. Now imagine if you had a dictionary and you had to look up each of those words at an average rate of 5 words for every 2 minutes. That's kind of the task that your brain is forced to do when you try to learn a foreign language. When you learn a foreign language, you need to kind of get to about 10,000 words in your understood vocabulary or your listening vocabulary before you have tolerably good comprehension. So you need to know enough words. And here's something else that makes this complicated for your brain. There's homonyms and homophones that your brain has to recognize and maybe store various possible definitions until, again, sense can be made of the utterance. For example, let's say the word bill was in my stream of speech. That could mean the beak of a bird. That could mean the name of a male. And it could mean a proposed law. And your brain needs to hold all of those options as possibilities until it makes sense of the utterance and you can discard the extras. That's even harder to do in foreign languages. I'm sorry if I'm going kind of fast. It's not my policy, but it's necessary. Adding in grammar cues. This is an amazing little part to me. Listen, grammar clues are a big part of understanding language. Listen to this sentence. It says this: 'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and jimble in the wabe. Now, this is a sentence written by Lewis Carroll, and what's awesome about this sentence is all the content words have been deleted and replaced with nonsense words. There's no content words in there. The only sensible words in that sentence are grammar clues. And school students have successfully illustrated this sentence just from reading Lewis Carroll's nonsense. The original sentence there was, 'Twas humid and the lively crabs did crawl and wiggle in the pool. The grammar cues are powerful. Then our brain has to group words into phrases, clauses, sentences. Listen to this. The horse raced past, the barn fell. Our brain wants to parse that. It wants to group that so that the horse raced. So the barn must have fallen, right? But in another context, that sentence could just as easily be understood to say, the horse that was raced past the barn fell. Right, the horse raced past the barn fell. So either way, it could be right. The last step is filling in massive missing detail. Okay, this can be done through cultural models or context. For instance, context. If you knew in the last example that the barn didn't fall, then you know that the horse fell that was raced past it. That's a context clue. How about this? I say to you, the coffee spilled, get the mop. Or I say to you, the coffee spilled, get the broom. That's a cultural model where we can understand. If I say get the broom, I probably mean the coffee grounds spilled or the tin of coffee spilled. If I say get the mop, my cup of coffee probably spilled, right? And we know that because we live in America. This is how we comprehend and produce speech no matter what language we speak. Once there was an American hitchhiking in Nigeria, and a car came past. The locals screeched off the road, jerked to a stop, jumped out, beat him to a pulp, and jumped back in, and went on their way. It was confusing to him until he realized that a thumbs up sign in Nigeria is incredibly disrespectful. Then he realized, all right? Unfortunately, that exact thing happens a lot when we're trying to learn a foreign language because words are no less symbolic of meaning than a gesture, all right? Now, let me stay with my... I don't want to go off-roading here too much. We understand each other because we know what the words mean. It's pretty basic, all right? But it's actually a huge concept because... How much time do I still have, Jonathan? how many? Two?
Four.
Okay, thank you. All right. Basically, just understand this. We experience life through mediums. Our lives are mediated through many different... We taste food, we hear speech, and just kind of go there in your mind for a second. And we have to interpret all those inputs. So when Richard Gregory said, all perception is theory-laden, all perception is theory-laden, he was 100% correct, because our life, our experience, is nothing more or less than a constantly revised, created theory of the inputs and what they mean. For instance, I see you clearly, so I can theorize from that the lights are off. All right? We're theorizing constantly about what these inputs mean. All right, this is important because we interpret words through our cultural understanding, our basic understanding of those words, right? So we should think of words actually as having two parts, phonetic and conceptual. For instance, I'm going to say a word to you, pancake. All right? So that word has two parts. It has the phonetic part. I just said pancake. I used my mouth to make that noise. But the word went into your head and created the concept. And because you know what a pancake is, the concept of a pancake was created in your head. So think of the word as being a tool with two parts, the phonetic part being the handle, the concept part being the head. I could do work in your head by gripping the concept part, the phonetic part of this word, right? I could say it, and then I knew basically what concept I was creating in your head. But sometimes we have the idea that we can just translate our words into another language when we're learning a foreign language, and then say them in the foreign language, and people will know what we're trying to say. But if I translate the word pancake into Bangla, it actually won't have any meaning, because there's no concept of pancake as such in Bangla, all right? And that tends to happen. What's happening here is we're using our cultural models of thought, putting somebody else's word to them or their tool handle to our tool head, and then expecting to get our concept across. We're not... So the concept here, according to Greg Thompson in his Growing Participator Approach to Language Learning, he says this is so important that calling it learning a language is basically a misnomer. We should call it entering into a lingua-cultural world, all right? And if I don't enter into a Bangladeshi lingua-cultural world, I'm going to be using my lingua-cultural world to try to communicate to them with their words. And their words don't necessarily communicate my lingua-cultural world, because the concepts are totally different. All right? So to be able to speak Bangla, I need to enter into their lingua-cultural world. That's what we call language learning. When I translate my speech into another language and talk, I'm using someone else's language to try to communicate my cultural world rather than entering into their lingua-cultural world and participating in that. So learning language. What is that? And how does that matter to us? Since learning a language is entering into somebody else's lingua-cultural world, it's not a job to be completed. It's a life to be lived. All right? Knowing this, comprehension is obviously going to be front center for three reasons. If I understand you, I can figure out how to respond to you, whether it's just with a nod of my head or a few words that I know. If I can't understand what you're saying, there's no conversation happening. Comprehension is important, number two, because if I am used to understanding you in your language, or the host in the host's language, I'm going to speak like the host, because remember, production is subject to comprehension. We want to comprehend our own speech. And if I'm used to comprehending things in a native speaker-like way, my comprehension is going to hit the red alert button if I produce in a non-host-like way, right? So that's why we need to learn to comprehend in a host-like way. That will affect our production. Number three, when entering someone else's lingua-cultural world, listening provides us with other culturally languicultural assets, like those cultural models we were talking about, the broom mop. It provides us with context, and it provides us with ongoing discourses. Example of that would be Trump's wall down by Mexico, right? We all know what it is. If somebody's talking about it, we can enter into that discussion and throw our opinion in the mix because, hey, it's an ongoing discourse in our languiculture. We're all involved with it. That's another thing you can pick up on as you listen and comprehend. So knowing this, is there value then? If the languiculture is so important to language learning, is there even value in learning languages in our schools? Yes. But there are some serious pitfalls here that we want to talk about very briefly. Two to be precise, maybe three. Most obviously, you're not going to have the languiculture in your school. Now, there are things you can do to help make that better. But one way to simply remedy this problem is if you just introduce your students to the fact that there is a languiculture that goes with these words they're learning, that helps a lot. If you introduce them to the importance of that languiculture, then learning the words isn't a waste of effort because they know that when they come to the culture, they can immerse themselves in that languiculture and learn what the words they speak actually mean in real life, not what they think they mean because of their English upbringing. Problem number two, I'm just going to hit this one briefly. A lot of curriculum focuses heavily on producing before comprehending. So we already talked about why comprehending is more important. And there's ways to remedy that too, but we're going to skip them. That would be a little bit time consuming. Three, and last, as far as pitfalls go, without the cultural world part of language, and I know this from experience, learning a language can feel useless to the student. Sometimes language classes away from the context of the language can convince students that they're too dumb to learn another language. That's what I thought until I went to Bangladesh. Even then, I wasn't too sure. But we can convince our students that they're too dumb to learn this stuff. Now, the remedying this one falls a little bit more into the category of inspiring your students to go to try harder, be more. But by bringing in some of the culture and some of the neat things from that culture, it can help a lot. But you know about inspiring your students, and that's just something to think about. So what are the benefits then of learning language in our schools? Well, and this is the part we already know. Language learning does include a lot of hard work. There's a lot of memorizing that is involved in learning another language. And initially, the only method we have of speaking and comprehending that language is through our native language, through the processes, the mechanism in our brain that we already learned with the language we were born into. And we just need to memorize a lot of words. It's hard work. And we know that children are better at memorizing than adults, and they're better at learning pronunciation than adults. And so if you can teach it to them while they're children, then that's good. So if we can teach them the words and accent and inspire them about the languicultural side of learning language, then they're miles ahead of where they were, even though they haven't entered into the languiculture at that point. They're still miles ahead of where they would be otherwise. And yeah, I think that's a benefit that we could capitalize on in our schools. Now, I actually have an idea that I think would maybe be a great idea, but I think I've used up all my grace and everything else. So if you're curious about what I think might be a really intriguing alternative answer to empowering our students to learn another language, feel free to ask me about it.